Well, Mike's ready, everybody, so let's get started. Exodus 19 tonight. If you're keeping count at home, we're actually almost to the halfway point of Exodus. There's 40 chapters in Exodus. I know it took us 2 years, I think, to get through Genesis, maybe a little bit longer than 2 years, but we're nearly to the halfway point of Exodus, and there's been some major events we've covered. And you might remember that last week, there's actually been some good follow-up discussion with, not to pick on Mike and a couple other people, about what we read last week. And I thought, you know, chapter 18 is not one of those chapters that jumps out in our mind because none of those big, massive, sweeping stories of the plagues or whatever happened in 18. But there's some good, very practical advice in chapter 18, I think, that we all understood and appreciated. I say all that to lead in the fact that when we get to chapter 19, we are on the doorstep, or the eve, or actually stepping through the doorstep of what I think, and what I think most of you would agree, is actually the most important thing that happens in the book of Exodus. We might say, well, getting the Israelites out of Egypt was the most important thing. The parting of the Red Sea jumps to my mind. But God's about to he's made his presence known to his people multiple times, of course, through the plagues and through the parting of the Red Sea and following the pillar of cloud and the pillar of fire. But what's coming next sets the stage for everything else. And you might think, well, we're going to hear about the Ten Commandments tonight. Well, not quite. Not in this chapter. Not in this chapter, but we're getting right there. Let me put it this way. We're at the base of the mountain in this chapter. It's a good way to put it. Maybe that's what I'll title our tonight's lesson when I put it online later. Exodus chapter 19. I'm not even going to go through all what I normally rigmarole. I talk about, well, where's a good stopping point? Where's a good pause point? We'll just see how it goes, because there's not any real natural stopping point in this chapter, I don't think. That's not to say we'll make it all the way through, but we might. So chapter 19, beginning in verse 1, and I'll read through a few verses, and we'll just back up and start walking through them. In the third month, after the sons of Israel had gone out of the land of Egypt, on this day they came into the wilderness of Sinai. Then they set out from Rephidim and came to the wilderness of Sinai and camped in the wilderness, and there Israel camped in front of the mountain. Let's stop there for just a second. I said we read a few verses. We read two. So this almost sounds like, well, they're already there. They're already in this area. What's going on here? Why is he backing up through this again? And most folks, and if you read it and you read what's coming next, verse 1 is kind of, I'm going to say this first. Verse 1 in the original language does not start as a typical change in story starts. So there's not, it's a word in the Hebrew, a wa, kind of like what we would think of when we say and. Telling something and, or there's not really that break, and you kind of see it. But it serves as a kind of a geographical caption to put our mind back around where they're at and what's going on. Where they're at. And actually, for the remainder of the book of Exodus, all events basically from this point forward related to the book occur in this wilderness of Sinai. So it's kind of just making sure we understand where they're at, reaffirming where they are as we look at this. So in verse 1 was the general statement that they had left Egypt. They were now the Sinai Desert. Verse 2 also gives us greater detail to the later part of that journey. So they set out from Rephidim. Remember, that's where they'd been at. That's where they got there. They were complaining. There was no water. Moses struck the rock. God told Moses to strike the rock, and water came out. That's where they were at just previously, Rephidim. And we get this greater detail. 17 and 18, both those chapters were there at Rephidim. They'd grumble because of lack of water. They'd fought against the Amalekites there. They went into the wilderness, and they pitched camp in front of the mountain, is what it tells us here. And we also read that in Exodus 18:5, where the Israelites are pictured as already dwelling in front of the mountain of God. What mountain is this mountain? Mount Sinai mountain is Horeb. What else happened at that mountain? We talked about it last week, I think, or the week before. What else happened at that mountain previously? Well, without that air conditioner running, it's quiet in here, isn't it? There's a bunch of y'all in here.
I know, but I don't want to be bad.
Okay, well, you are the James and not the Jim, so we understand that from you. Your brow's a little higher. the burning bush. When God, when Moses met with God at the burning bush, was on this same mountain. Now, it's worth asking the question now. I didn't print out a map for y'all tonight as I have in the past, but what's, and many of y'all's Bibles may have this in your Bible, of the route of the Exodus, right? There's tour groups that go over there and they follow the route of the Exodus. So, but then there's questions of, well, where's Mount Sinai? Hey, did y'all know that? Not everybody is 100% certain that this mountain here in particular is Mount Sinai. Actually, there's two places that people basically would argue about. One of them's a little further over on the other side of the Jordan, actually. And the one that I believe he's talking about here is kind of in the southern part of the Sinai Peninsula, where Mount Horeb would be. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. We don't know the exact route because nobody was, you know, dropping pins on their Google Maps as they were traveling back then or anything. But I think that's something that I think is kind of important. Well, we'll get that in just a minute. They're there at the same mountain. And they camped at the front of the mountain. So, that being said, let's make sure we know where we are, what mountain they're at, and that this is kind of just resetting the scene for us, verse 1 and 2, just really circling back and giving us the scene of it. So, verse 3. Now Moses went up to God, and Yahweh the Lord called to him from the mountain, saying, "Thus you shall say to the house of Jacob, and tell the sons of Israel, you yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians and how I lifted you up on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. So now then, if you indeed listen to my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be my treasured possession among all the peoples, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words that you shall speak to the sons of Israel." Let me pause there. All y'all that were here on Sunday will know, once again, the providence of God is so amazing that he led us to the exact place in 1 Peter chapter 2 where Peter's quoting the very verse that I knew we would be in today, 3 days later, if the Lord gave us the 3 days between Sunday and Wednesday. And here we are, and here we're reading the same verses that we happen to be in. And I couldn't have planned that if I wanted to plan it. But nothing's impossible for God. That blows me away, honestly. It does. I mean, I should never be in doubt of something God does, and this might seem kind of inconsequential or minuscule, but I don't think it is at all. I think it's pretty amazing to see God's providence in everything, and even in this, that we're in the exact same place where the Apostle Peter was quoting 2,000 years ago that we happened to be preaching on last Sunday. It's just amazing to me. But I'm easily entertained, apparently. So at the foot of the mountain, Moses goes up the mountain, ascends the mountain. There God speaks to him and tells him to speak to the Hebrews. So what role is God? Moses has already been in this role. What is the role or title we would say that Moses is carrying with him in this relational aspect between God and the people? Intercessor, mediator, right? He's in that role. God has put him in that role before he ever went back to Egypt. Whenever he told him, "You're going to go get him out," he's the intercessor, the mediator between... Now, so he's been, I think, intercessor and mediator are very similar words from a legal standpoint, brother. Is there a major difference legally?
No.
So, practically,
the word you use more often than intercessor.
Right. And a mediator, oftentimes, in my mind at least, I'm asking Roy because of his legal background, law background, I should say, almost makes it sound like you were, you know, have faced the legal system on the other side, but.
Seen it all.
Seen it all, he says. But to me, an intercessor acts on behalf in this wide range of things, right? Where a mediator is usually a more specific task and role, often law. Here we're going to see in covenant. So his role before wasn't really the covenant between God, the negotiate, or not negotiate is not even the right word. It would be for us, but not for God. But before he was intercessor of directions and leadership and telling them where to go and what to do. This is a little bit of shift right here about what's to come as he's to be the mediator of this, in this covenant. Okay, so the message Moses is to proclaim is what? It's a threefold message, isn't it? What is he telling him to do? "You shall say to the house of Jacob and tell the sons of Israel, you yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians." So first and foremost, remember and recognize who I am and what I've already done for you. Tracking? Everybody good? That's what he's telling him to say to him first. Before he says anything else, that's what he tells Moses, you to tell the people, remember who I am and what I've done for you. and that I've delivered you out of slavery. And then what does he say? And how I lifted you up on eagle's wings. Lifted you up on eagle's wings. Now, this isn't the only place we've seen, and this is probably not the first place you think of hearing that term of being lifted up on eagle's wings. Where else do we think about it? Where else do we hear that language? Sir, what was that? When they crossed the Red Sea, absolutely. But where else in Scripture do we see that phrase of like he carried us or them upon the wings of eagles?
It's a Zion motto, but I can't remember what
it is. It is a Zionistic motto for sure.
I mean, the school, Zion.
He's talking about Zion Christian Academy where Claire goes. That's the, what is the word I'm looking for? It's their mascot is what I'm looking for. Yeah, their mascot's an eagle. So, yeah. Diane's looking feverishly over there to try to find.
We got
cheat notes. They got cheat notes, yeah, them study Bibles. Yeah. Footnotes in their Bibles and that kind of thing. We'll come back to that. Somebody finds it. We can come back to that. The other thing here he tells to them is what? And I have brought you to myself, right? I'm the one that destroyed them on your behalf, but for God's glory. I've carried you on eagle's wings. I brought you, Brother Charles talks about crossing the Red Sea. I have brought you, taken you, cared for you, and he's brought them where? To himself. Remember last week or the week before, I guess, when we were talking about when they were at Rephidim and there was no water, they were grumbling against Moses and they were aggravated, and we were like, yeah, we would be aggravated and frustrated too. We'd be walking through the desert and there's no water where you've made us camp at. Who brought them there? Who led them there? God did. God led them there. He led them through this harsh place to a place where there's no water at the end of their harsh journey. I don't want to go all back and teach that lesson again, but why? Why did he do that? Why would he do that? Does he still do that kind of thing?
I think he does. He led them there. He wanted them to thirst, I believe.
Yeah, I agree with you.
To draw them closer to him, to trust him.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so does he do the same thing today?
Sure.
He may not drag us literally through the desert to a place with no physical water, but he drags us through a desert on purpose to a place with no water on purpose. So we will trust him. I think I'm
Mark. Participation.
Now we don't do participation trophies.
Only winners and losers.
I'll check and see if I can. I'll look for a star later. Yeah. Yeah. I'll give you whatever is in my back left pocket.
No, thank you.
Deuteronomy 32. The wings of eagles are depicted there, not just in carrying them across, but also in this manner. Listen to this. For the Lord's portion is his people, Jacob his allotted inheritance. In a desert land he found him, in a barren and howling waste. He shielded him and cared for him. He guarded him as the apple of his eye, like an eagle that stirs up its nest and hovers over its young, that spread its wings to watch them and carries them in its pinions. That's verse 9 through 11 of Deuteronomy 32, if you're taking notes. So there's many aspects of this eagle, right? Not just that, but the protection and the covering and the looking over the little ones and all that kind of stuff. That was in Deuteronomy 32. So he's told them, remember who I am. Here's what I've done. I brought you here. I've not just brought you here, but I brought you to me here. Really? I mean, you think about that. It's pretty comforting, not always easily comforting, but comforting to say that God brought me where I'm at. But he didn't just bring them somewhere and left them over here while he's over there, did he? He said, I brought you to myself, is what this text tells us. That also tells us he's right there where there is no water. Where at the end of the day, he's there. He's everywhere. And so now, if you will indeed listen to my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be, this is verse 5, you shall be my treasure possession among all the peoples, for all the earth is mine. He says, you'll be mine if you do this, but all the earth's mine anyway. Do y'all see a potential contradiction there at all that he's saying, you'll be mine, but all the earth's mine anyway? Yeah, they're both true, aren't they? Yeah. Diane, you got something?
I just think he's giving them authority over the full birth when he says it's all mine to do. You know, I have the right to give you that authority because I don't
know. Okay, I see what you're saying. He's not talking in, not 100% that he possesses both. He's saying, since I possess both, I can give you, kind of like he did Adam in the garden, right?
That,
he also says there is treasured possession.
They're his treasured possession. My treasured possession. Now, y'all remember Sunday we talked about what it means to be the possession of God, right? That it means, in the Greek, it's a word that usually leads to purchasing, right? We talked about that Sunday, I think the preacher said that on Sunday, right? That word kind of means that. In the Hebrew, though, in this, the word used for possession in the Hebrew is different, and it literally means a special treasure, and that term almost always refers to something that belongs personally to a king. So not, I mean, a personal thing that he owns. So that's the language as it's used in the Hebrew compared to how it was used in the Greek that we talked about Sunday morning. So we start stepping into the covenant language here. This is covenantal language beginning. If you will, this if and or if then clausing. So God requires Israel to keep the covenant by obeying his commandments. I know this pops a lot of questions up in your mind of, well, is this a completely conditional covenant? Are there unconditional covenants? Are there conditional covenants in Scripture? Is that a deeper question then? Yeah. What's an example that God gives us of an unconditional covenant?
The promise that he made to Abraham.
Right? The promise that he made to Abraham. It wasn't an if then, right? That's the difference. It's not an if then. The promise he made to Abraham. The promise of the rainbow, the Noah covenant, right? That he would never again flood the earth because of man. What about these if-thens, though? Does that upset God's providence and God's sovereignty in some way to have an if-then clause in a covenant? Y'all see what I'm asking? Does it upset God's plan and purpose to have an if-then? This goes back to what we talk about often, specifically in salvation, but the fact that God is sovereign, all that he wills to take place will take place, okay? And yet man is responsible for their actions. And we cannot completely grasp that. We can get pretty close.
This is written to us, so it's really, if we do this, then we are his. It's really to show us.
Yes. Yeah, it took me a second to get where you're going. I know where you're going now.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's how we're reading it. It's more like, you will do this if you are mine.
So are we saying, y'all catch what John's saying there? What he's saying, if I might extrapolate on what John said. Well, I interpret what you said, okay. Was it Greek or Hebrew? So what he's saying is, when you see these if-then statements, especially in a covenantal language, it's not for God to get something from it, because what can we give to God anyway? It's for us to understand our position before God. Similar to when you go to the Beatitudes and people try to take the Beatitudes and flip them on their head and make them this, follow these orders so you can get blessed. No. The Beatitudes, as Jesus taught the Beatitudes, was not that at all. I think that was the very first sermon series I preached through here five and a half years ago. It's, blessed are you when this is true of you, showing that you are his, so you are blessed, and this is true in your life. That's kind of how this goes. Kind of like before you're saved, you have no desire whatsoever to follow God's law, right? I mean, that's not a desire you have whatsoever. Post-conversion, though, you have a desire and a love to want to live on behalf of this God who saved you. You have something, brother?
We know that Israel did not hold up.
They don't take them very long either.
And it took Christ for God to ultimately hold up the promise that he made. But that was done.
Yep. And yet, yeah, I agree with you 100%. And yet the Messiah was slain before the foundation of the world in the mind and timing of God. So it was always going to happen that way. So then again, it's to show us, kind of like with our faith, right? When God tests you and tests your faith, he knows where your faith is. You don't know it as well as you think you do. So it's proving God is using those trials and temptations and testings in your life to show to you the love of your faith. Not him. He knows what it is. Yes, sir. Is this going to be some really good? Okay.
I thought all along the Israelites, and even today, some are his treasure possession.
Oh, you want to go there tonight?
Well, I thought it's raining.
It's raining. Got nowhere else to go.
Give me a remnant.
That's what, yeah, the remnant, that gets into a very deep conversation that I'm more than willing to have, just not right now.
Okay.
Don't forget me, though.
Okay, I won't forget you. I'll bring it, I will come back to it when I bring your stickers for you. So a kingdom of priests, a holy nation. I mean, this is language we just looked at, right? The promises for us today, now, if you're in Christ. These are the words you're to speak to the sons of Israel. So Moses, you go back and tell the people this. Go tell them this. That's what he's telling them to say. Now, Israel as a covenant community will be made into a kingdom. They haven't been in the kingdom yet. This language would really sound, I mean, they've been a bunch of slaves for 430 years. But to go back to what Roy said earlier about the covenant, the Abrahamic covenant, he'd promised them long before that he would make them a people, that he would bring them into a land. I mean, those things are coming to fruition. That's why I'm saying this is so exciting. Not just the Ten Commandments and what we're about to see, the thunder and lightning coming from the mountain, but this is, we've been talking about this for so long, the establishment, we talked about it at the end of Genesis, the establishment of the nation of Israel, it's really starting to get some legs right here because God is giving it legs. And a holy nation. We've talked about the word holy so many times in the Greek. I talk about it a lot, right? We talked about it on Sunday. It means what? To cut or separate, to be distinct, and to be made distinct. So what does it mean in the Hebrew when it says a holy anything? Well, I'm glad you're wondering. The word in Hebrew means the exact same thing. To set apart, to be distinct, to make unique, is to be holy. And has the nation of Israel always to this day still been distinct in that way? Absolutely. Why do you think everybody hates them so much? Most everybody hates them so much. The majority of the world hates Israel. And they're not doing things right now that's endearing a lot more people to their side either, by the way. That's a different discussion too. We'll talk about that when I bring the stickers also. So these three blessings apply to the people of God today, don't they? We just looked at this. A footnote to a commentary I looked at. Guess who he quoted? He quoted 1 Peter chapter 2, because we just did all this. So I don't have to walk back through that if you were here last Sunday. If you weren't here last Sunday, shame on you, but you can go online and listen to it. I think all y'all were here last Sunday, though, so no shame on anybody here. I found this comment. I stopped this comment short because I don't agree with the last part of it, so I'm not even going to read that part to you. But I want to read this part to you. And this is somebody commenting, a theologian named Clowney, and he says this, Peter's declaration, talking about 1 Peter, of our peoplehood in Christ has vast consequences for the life of the church in Christ. The church is not just a religious association formed by saved individuals to give united expressions to their faith. Rather, the church is more a people than Israel was under the old covenant. The way in which we're united is a lot different. Something to think about.
Depends on what you call a church.
Depends on what you call a church.
It's the same. That's true.
Yeah. There's really, I agree with you. Yeah, there's really, There's a lot out there wearing the name church that aren't the church, but the true church of God. Let's move on. So Moses came and called the elders of the people and set before them all these words which Yahweh the Lord had commanded him. And all the people answered together and said, all that Yahweh the Lord has spoken we will do. And Moses brought back the words of the people to Yahweh the Lord. I need to stop there for just a second. Listen, this people, these folks, Moses comes back and tells them these things, and their response overwhelmingly, apparently, is, we'll do it all. What have they been told that God was going to require of them? What did God tell Moses he was going to require of the Hebrews to this point? Don't think ahead about what you know about what's coming. At this point, what had God told Moses that the Hebrews must do in order to receive these blessings?
Obey me fully, keep my covenant.
What did they know about what he was going to ask them to obey to do, though? They didn't know, right?
They could gather double manna on Friday.
They knew about the manna and they knew the Sabbath. So they're agreeing wholeheartedly with whatever. It sounds good, don't it? But think about it for a minute.
It's still
contagious. It is absolutely contagious. That's why I really thought about this differently as I read through it this week, the past couple of days, is, man, they didn't know what they were going into. And they're agreeing wholeheartedly. But they were just aggravated just a couple of days before at Moses and God, and yet now they're all in. What do you mean by it's contagious, brother?
You get caught up in the I can do that. Yeah, and the whole legalism that is infecting so much of the church.
So he's saying legalism, how it affects the church too. There's another thing I thought about here. How emotionally driven and responsive we can be on something too. Just in that emotional moment.
Exactly. They wouldn't say no.
Do what?
They wouldn't say no,
but the way the text reads in the original and then with the exclamation points in the new English translations, it's like everybody's all in. I'm sure there have been some outliers, but as a group, they're all in, and they don't even know what God's about to require of them yet, except obey me. What does that mean to them? What have they seen about God so far? He destroyed the Egyptians. That's good. He destroyed the Amalekites. That's another good one. Yeah. He gave them water. He led them somewhere without water, but then he gave them water. Part of the Red Sea. Had wiped out. Had done all these things with these plagues and spared them when they could know that these plagues were going on right outside their doorstep. Freedom from bondage after 400 years. He'd done a lot of good for them. That tasty manna, yeah. Their clothes are, we ain't got to that point yet, but their clothes aren't wearing out. We ain't got very far into their journey yet, but those of y'all who don't know, spoiler alert, their clothes don't wear out for 40 years.
You don't get diseases.
Yeah, the health. So, is it wrong?
What can go wrong?
What can go wrong? I like that. So Moses comes down from the mountain, goes to the camp. They're all in, apparently. Calls the elders together. Who are these elders? The elders of the people. Verse 7, who are these folks? So Jethro in the previous chapter had said, hey, set up these, align it in this way, and this way, and this way. We also have that thought, we had a good discussion, y'all may not remember, quite a while back about the setting aside of the firstborn into kind of a priesthood before the line of Aaron, before the Levites and all that stuff. Those may have been intermingled with some of this as well.
Just the old folks,
possibly. But elder doesn't necessarily, when we say elder, it doesn't always necessarily mean the old folks, but especially biblically speaking. But anyway, we don't know for sure. It's just interesting conversation. But we just read in the previous chapter about him appointing these people over these groups. So that's a very likely candidate for who these were. And he gave those characteristics of what kind of people to look for. So these have been people of high character that knew all this kind of stuff, right? So there's an immediate response. The Hebrew word for together, what did I read? Where did we stop at? Okay. All that Yahweh had spoken, we will do. All the people answered together. Together is the word I'm looking for there in verse 8. Together, the original word in Hebrew, means in unitedness. We might say unanimously is what the word means in Hebrew. Now again, we say all sometimes, like there was a fire over there, all the fire department came out. You know, three or four may not have been there. But we say it that way, so there could have been some outliers there. But again, how are they, to Diane's point, how are they going to say no at this point? Verse 9, Yahweh said to Moses, behold, I will come to you in a thick cloud so that the people may hear when I speak with you and may also believe in you forever. Then Moses told the words of the people to Yahweh. Yahweh the Lord also said to Moses, go to the people and set them apart as holy today and tomorrow and let them wash their garments. Probably shouldn't have read that verse just yet, but verse 9, behold, I will come to you in a thick cloud, the people may hear when I speak with you and may also believe in you forever. Then Moses told the words of the people to Yahweh. Believe in you, yeah.
Believe in you.
Which makes sense, though, because, you know, when Moses dies, part of the reason that God wouldn't, or whatever happened to Moses, he wouldn't let Moses' body go back to the people, because what would they have done? They would have worshipped him. So God tells Moses that he will appear before the Hebrews in a thick, dark cloud. So what, hadn't they been seeing this whole time anyway? Hadn't they been following a cloud around during the daytime and a pillar of fire at night? Is this talking about the same, is this something different that God's saying he's about to do? There's going to be noises, voices, depending on the translation. Moses is going to know what's being said. We're about to see some, this isn't just your run-of-the-mill white puffy cloud. I think the cloud we're about to see is not the same kind of cloud they were following around by day and night.
This one probably had lightning.
Lightning, thunder. We're going to get to that in just a minute. But he's going to come down. He's going to descend down in that place. Come to you in a thick cloud. I can see he didn't say coming down there just yet. But why? So this is what? A theophany, right? A visible manifestation of God in a way that we can see. And may believe in you forever. How does this make the people believe in Moses?
If they hear God talk to Moses directly, that will make them trust that Moses can hear God the next time.
Yeah. Even though he's given them no reason to doubt, but yeah.
They end up doubting.
They doubt.
The authority, and this is God saying, this is my stamp of authority. And they, because the thing is, they denied the stamp later on. Agreed, but they didn't do it, what they were supposed to do.
Right.
And that was immediately when they didn't start trusting Moses, because they said, well, you aren't our leader anymore.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It had to do with the imprimatur, if I use the word of God.
Fancy word there. No, that's a fancy word. You get that, James?
What'd she say?
So, yeah, lowercase c or uppercase c? So something else, in the original language, when it says cloud here, I asked y'all if it's the same kind of cloud. When it says cloud here, typically the pillar cloud that they're following is a one Hebrew word, anon. There's a second term that's a simple term, ab. It signifies a very dark cloud. And when you see a very dark cloud, what does that typically signify in the agency and authority of God?
Judgment.
Judgment.
Yeah. They need to be scared, basically.
They're about to be. They're about to be. It often symbolizes judgment against the wicked. Perhaps I saw Philip Ryken said, perhaps it's a physical warning to the people not to rebel against God or his servant Moses. But like Diane just said, that doesn't stick. For the benefit of the weak Hebrews too, that since they left Egypt, they've been living by sight, right? Now they're about to hear. And they're still going to see, but they're going to hear also. So Moses, as we read, go to the people. God told Moses, go to the people, set them apart as holy today and tomorrow, and let them wash their garments. And let them be ready for the third day, for on the third day, Yahweh the Lord will come down on Mount Sinai in the sight of all the people. Why is he telling them to go wash your clothes? I guess if you're going to tell them to wash their clothes, surely he's going to provide water for them. I read, set them apart as holy. Some of y'all's translations probably say, you shall consecrate them today and tomorrow. Same thing, different word, saying the same thing. Why do they need to go do this? Why do they need to set themselves apart, wash their clothes?
It's like Moses taking off his shoes. It's an act of reverence for what they're about to have.
Respect, reverence, coming into the presence of holiness.
Well, yeah, and they were a filthy mess.
They would have been a filthy mess, too. If you think back to Genesis 35:2, let me read this from you. This is not something that God just come up with right here. Genesis 35:2. So Jacob said to his household and to all who were with him, put away the foreign gods which are among you and cleanse yourselves and change your garments. They didn't have a change of clothes, so you just got to wash them. Joshua 3:5, which is after this, of course. Then Joshua said to the people, set yourselves apart as holy for tomorrow. Yahweh will be do wondrous deeds among you. So the setting apart, this preparation there, there's something, you got to have some skin in the game. And you need to set yourself apart as different and distinct. It makes me think of later on some of the laws about the purification laws, washing hands, and that kind of thing that are coming to play. It also makes me think about when we were in Israel and the mikvah, the ceremonial baths that were outside of all these places before you go into them. And even we did mikvah one morning. Malay didn't get up early enough for it, but most of the rest of us went out to the Sea of Galilee that morning and did a mikvah. And we kind of, I don't want to use the term, this rededication that people flow around so flippantly, but it was kind of a cutting away or stripping away of yourself and spending time with God alone and going into the waters kind of ceremonially. Not that it made me Jewish or anything, but I felt right about doing it for sure. Where are we at? Verse 11. So after 2 days of preparation, God will descend in Shekinah glory on Mount Sinai in the presence of the people on the third day. I don't want to get too wrapped up on 3 days. We know numbers are important in the Bible, right? 40. Marty sent me something today about 40 and all these times 40 is referenced in there. 3 is an important day. 7 is an important day. Number. What about 3? Well, the first thing we're going to go to New Covenant-wise is Jesus in the grave, right? 3 days. But if we back up a little bit, back up a whole lot, actually, to Isaac, Abraham and Isaac, let me read this for you. In the story of the offering of Isaac by his father Abraham, which we know is picturing God the Father and Christ the Son, right? He takes his son, he takes the kindling to start the fire for the sacrifice. Who carries that kindling? The son does. Who carried the cross? Jesus the son carried the cross. Took him 3 days to get there. In that 3 day time period, also part of this preparing yourself for 3 days, same thing with Abraham, is this wasn't a knee-jerk thing, right? 3 days to think about it. 3 days to prepare yourself. 3 days to get your heart right. Same as Jonah. But the 3 days, I think, when I'm thinking about Abraham as he's going up there, is wrestling in his mind with, I don't have a sacrifice except for my son. And God told me to come sacrifice my son. Are you willing to go do that? And his trust that was there that we don't read about until there at the very end was that God would prepare this, would give a sacrifice. And he did. Yeah. His trust in God. But 3 days of him wrestling with that. It's not apples and apples, but it's close. So it's 3 days to prepare, to ponder, and then he's going to come down. Verse 12. You shall set bounds for the people all around, saying, beware that you do not go up on the mountain or touch the border of it. Whoever touches the mountain shall surely be put to death. No hand shall touch him, but he shall surely be stoned or surely shot through. Whether man or whether beast or man, he shall not live. When the ram's horn sounds a long blast, they shall come up to the mountain. So Moses went down from the mountain to the people, set the people apart as holy, and they washed their garments. And he said to the people, be ready for the third day. Do not go near a woman. Some of you men are like, all right, but if you get to that part, some of you women might be thinking the same thing. Let's back up. Verse 12, set bounds for the people all around. What's that mean? You can come no further than here. All the way around the mountain, you're to come no further than here, people. Why? Well, they don't have to guess about it, do they? God told Moses to tell them why. You come near, touch this mountain, you're going to be killed. Why would God do that?
Still trying to scare him.
Well, he's holy, holy, holy.
He is holy, holy, holy. Okay.
Even today, if we were to, for some reason, be in his presence, it would be like walking in a radiation-filled atmosphere.
So fear and protection for the people? Is that what you're trying to say? Just to protect the people too? Or are you just saying he's telling them, one of them, you can't come here?
And it will happen. Unless we're covered by the blood of Jesus.
Yeah. We can't stand in his presence.
No.
Unless we're wrapped in the righteousness of Christ Jesus. It's these people that try to say, well, when I'll get up there and I'll tell God this and I'll tell God that. No, you won't. No, you won't. That's not how it's going to work. As Paul Washer says, you will melt in front of him like a candle in front of a blast furnace, if he so desires.
Yeah.
What's that, Job said what?
Job shut up when he saw God.
He sure did, didn't he? Did you hear what Brother Charles said? He said Job shut up when he saw God. Well, I mean, let's think about some of the examples we saw in Genesis when people come in the presence of an angel. They fall down. Some of them like dead men. And that's an angel who, I hope, let's not misunderstand the fact that it's not like the angels are almost like God. They're nothing like God either. But in the presence of angels, people fall on their face like dead men.
We were just reading in Revelations today, and the angel came down and spoke, and he was just covered with the glory of God, of brightness.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. And if you look at the description of some angels, unless they take on human form, some of the angels are pretty scary looking if you look at what the Bible describes them as. Some of you are thinking, what? They take on human form. That's not either their natural form.
We don't see them in that. We would rather
not. No, we would. You're actually right. We would never, rather not. He shall surely be stoned or surely shot through. Whether beast or man, he shall not live. So their livestock, hey, you better make sure your cows don't get over close to the mountain either, because they'll get took out. When the ram's horn sounds, hold on. I want to make sure I make a comment about this. Between verse 12 and 13. So if you go to the mountain and touch the mountain, you surely be put to death. No hand shall touch him. What does that say? You're not even supposed to touch the person who touched the mountain. That's what it's saying. Don't let that little part right there skip by you.
Just need to leave them there dead.
When they come back, they're going to stone them.
Yeah, but then they just leave them there dead. They can't touch them.
Yeah.
It's kind of like if lightning struck.
The vultures need to eat too, I guess.
If lightning struck Mary and I touched Mary, we both get zapped. Never mind.
Don't get zapped by lightning, Mary. He's going to leave you laying there. When the ram's horn sounds a long blast, I shall go up to the mountain. Is that where we stopped? Nope. So Moses went down from the mountain to the people and set the people apart as holy, washed their garments, and they washed their garments. I'm sorry, Moses wasn't in the laundry business. And he said to the people, be ready for the third day. Do not go near a woman. So what does that mean?
That's another foreshadowing of Levitical law that we've had a few of them now. That
yeah.
That you don't remain clean.
The uncleanliness and the sexual purification, all that, really two things are going on there. We won't go all the way in detail of that, but I think ultimately, even in that, what it's talking about is you're supposed to be single-mindedly focused on consecrating yourself before God comes down. Really what it's talking about. So, if they weren't scared yet, now Moses is telling them, all right, by the way, guys, God's coming down. You're going to see him in the cloud. You're going to see him manifested in this cloud. We're going to do whatever he says, Moses. Good. I'll tell God that. He does. God sends Moses back. Y'all catching me? Moses is going up and down this mountain a lot. And he's going to do it a few more times too. And he goes, okay. You separate yourself for 3 days. Clothes need to be washed. Purify yourself. Don't be with your spouse. And if you touch the mountain, God's going to kill you. If your cow touches the mountain, God's going to kill you. This might, if there wasn't fear before, it might be starting to rise in the back of their mind just a little bit. You have something, brother?
Going back to the very first discussion about mediator and intercessor, maybe there is a difference. A mediator works on compromises. Moses just delivered messages.
Aaron's almost, or messengers, yeah. I was wondering if anybody was going to ask that. Did y'all hear what Diane asked? Who's blowing the trumpet? And we got an answer to that?
Yeah, they wanted to do it in Revelation.
I read ahead.
Okay.
The sound was so loud that people trembled. Only one person can do that.
Yeah, I agree with you. And when you go to Revelation, there's comments there about angels doing this kind of thing. And angels are given authority and responsibilities from God. It doesn't tell us here, God or from an angel, but the fact that it's, I thought about the exact same thing, Diane. I was like, if anybody in here is going to ask me that question, I know who it's going to be. And it was. That's not a bad thing. I thought about it too. Yeah. So it's from God. But I think it could very well be an angel that's blowing it too. And still be from God, right? It's supernatural because of what you said when you read ahead. It's definitely supernatural. Trumpets show up through the Bible a lot.
Something very important, like the second coming.
The second coming. A lot of times in the Old Testament we read about it too.
Jericho.
Well, there's a little bit of some different things going on there. So they're about to come to this mountain. You can't touch it. Now, let me read something for you. In Hebrews 12. Hebrews 12, verses 18 through 24. Consider the establishment of the old covenant, which is really what we're seeing here. When we talk about the old covenant, this is, right? Hebrews chapter 12, verses 18 through 24. This is the contrast. I think I've talked about this on Sunday mornings too, the contrast recently about Mount Sinai and Mount Zion. Again, our Sundays and Wednesdays are so closely aligned, it's got to be a God thing. Because like I said, I'm not smart enough to plan that out like that. Hebrews chapter 12, verse 18. For you have not come to a mountain, speaking of believers, New Covenant believers, you have not come to a mountain that can be touched, and to a blazing fire, and to darkness and gloom and whirlwind, and to the blast of a trumpet, and the sound of words, which was such that those who heard begged that no further word be spoken to them. For they could not bear what was being commanded. If even a beast touched the mountains, it will be stoned. So he's referencing back to what we're reading tonight. And so terrible was what happened that Moses said, I am full of fear and trembling, but you have come to Mount Zion, to the city of the living God, and the heavenly Jerusalem, and to myriads of angels, to the feastal gathering and assembly of the firstborn who are enrolled in heaven, and to God the judge of all, to the spirits of the righteous made perfect, and to Jesus the mediator of a new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood which speaks better than the blood of Abel. Sam, there's the difference. There's the difference. Well, I said there's no good stopping point. So I guess verse 15 is as good as any. Because next week, Lord willing, if he gives us 7 more days. Does that bother any of y'all when I say that? No. When I say if God gives us... Okay. We should be looking forward to that. I'd rather gather with y'all in glory tomorrow. Yeah, so we'll pick up and probably finish the chapter next week, but we'll see. Some of the stuff we just read about in Hebrews hasn't really happened yet, right? This flaming fire, all this stuff. I doubt that Jim is the only one that's read ahead. I just realized there's Jim, and James all sitting together right there.
Well, we team up.
We kind of planned it that way.
Yeah, yep. Kind of planned it.
We're going to get the rest of Jim together and start
the club. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So we'll stop there. Somebody earmark that verse 15, and we'll pick back up in verse 16. Any other thoughts on that tonight, the text we've been in so far? Kind of just getting ready for what's coming, right? I mean, that's really what we've been reading, is getting ready for what's coming. Yeah, and we'll get when the horn starts blowing, I'll talk about that a little bit more next week. But that's an interesting thing, and it's used, you know, like the shofar or ram's horn or whatever. Is that what they're talking about here? The shofar, the ram's horn that you see.